Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And leading off, we're going to summarize some of the top news in science. Leading off, last week was the 25th anniversary of the horrible Chernobyl nuclear accident. Yes, it was in late April 1986 that the world awoke to the fact that there was a raging nuclear fire and explosion at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, which would change the course of nuclear power not just in Russia or the Ukraine, but on the planet Earth itself. The largest nuclear accident of its type, perhaps 25% or more of the uranium core blew up and was sent into the atmosphere. And even today, 25 years later, there's a dead zone roughly 19 miles in radius surrounding the Chernobyl plant. And speaking about Chernobyl, the situation in Japan seems to be stable right now. Stable in the sense of a ticking time bomb. In other words, it's a race against time. On one hand, we have the possibility of another earthquake, another pipe break, another hydrogen gas explosion, which could tip the reactors into a full-scale meltdown. And on the other hand, we also have a 30-year plan devised by the Hitachi Corporation to finally put that reactor to rest. And also, on the physics front, we actually have two rather interesting stories. The first is that Brookhaven National Laboratory in Long Island, scientists have created the largest number of anti-helium atoms ever created. For every particle, we think there's an antiparticle. Therefore, there's an anti-hydrogen. And now, scientists have created anti-helium, consisting of two antiprotons and two antineutrons. And of course, that could be the beginning of an antichemistry. And also, the Higgs boson, the missing link in what is called the Standard Model. There's some tantalizing clues that perhaps it's been found at the Large Hadron Collider, or it could just be a hoax. And let me also say that I just completed a grueling 10-city book tour across the United States, promoting my latest book, Physics of the Future. And I'm proud to say that my publisher will be donating copies of my bestseller, Physics of the Future, to various radio stations to raise funds to keep public radio alive and well. I'm also proud to say that because of you, the listener, Physics of the Future hit the New York Times bestseller list. That's right, Physics of the Future, it's official now. It's a New York Times bestseller, and it's all because of you, the listener, supporting the work of Exploration. Well, let's just jump right into some of the top stories of the past week. Believe it or not, last week marked the 25th anniversary of the worst nuclear disaster, the Chernobyl nuclear accident, which took place in late April 1986. It was a horrible accident. There was a hydrogen gas explosion. There was a steam explosion, which blew the containment structure apart. An enormous amount of fission products were sent into the air. And radiation was first detected, not in Russia or the Ukraine, but in Europe. Radiation alarms were set off at various nuclear power plants in Europe. At first, the Europeans thought it was a nuclear meltdown in Europe, only to discover later that there was a raging fire at the Chernobyl nuclear power station outside Kiev. Well, believe it or not, 25 years later, that accident still has not been put to rest. Hard to believe. First of all, it took 600,000 workers. Let me repeat that number again. 600,000 workers to put that nuclear accident finally to rest. Many of them could only go into lethal radiation fields for a few minutes. And Gorbachev gave every single one of them, all 600,000, a medal for their work in terms of putting that reactor accident to rest. First of all, it took about 10 days just to put out the fire. Gorbachev called out the Red Air Force. Helicopters sandbagged that reactor with sand, concrete, and boric acid. And then it took many years after that to entomb it in a gigantic sarcophagus of concrete.
And even then, it's still radioactive. Even then, the core is still burrowing its way into the ground, believe it or not. Well, the situation in Japan is stable, but stable in the sense of a ticking time bomb. Just like the situation in Chernobyl, we have the cores in melted form. The cores, however, did not blow the reactor vessels apart. The containment structure was blown apart in four facilities in Japan, but we did not have the uncontrolled release of large amounts of uranium into the atmosphere, at least not yet. And that's why it's a race against time. On one hand, we have the valiant workers trying to put the reactor accident to rest. But, hey, another earthquake, a pipe break, a hydrogen gas explosion could send the reactor accident all over again. Hitachi Corporation has come out with a plan. They say that perhaps within a year, they might be able to stabilize the reactor. And then in 30 years, says the Hitachi Corporation, they might finally put that reactor accident to rest. And also news on the physics front. The Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland, well, there was a post on the internet, it could be a hoax, indicating that perhaps they found the elusive Higgs boson, which is the last missing piece of a jigsaw puzzle of subatomic particles called the Standard Model. It could be a hoax, however, so don't get your hopes up too high. But at the Brookhaven National Laboratories in Long Island, we have a confirmed detection of antihelium. That's right. For every particle, there's an antiparticle. The antiparticle of the electron is the positron. We've discovered the antiproton. And now antihelium, consisting of two antiprotons and two antineutrons. One day, we may even have an antichemistry. It would be extremely expensive. Antimatter is some of the most exotic, expensive material on the planet Earth. However, one day, perhaps, we may drive our starships with antimatter. At least that's the hope. It turns out that antimatter, when combined with ordinary matter, releases enormous amounts of radiation. In fact, it is the most efficient way to extract energy from ordinary matter. And one day, perhaps we'll use it to take us to the stars. A conventional rocket going to the nearest star would take about 70,000 years. That's simply too long to make a starship practical. So one thing that could drive a starship might be antimatter. A teaspoon, just a teaspoon of matter combined with a teaspoon of antimatter would be enough to generate more energy than a hydrogen bomb. So some scientists predict that perhaps that's the way to go. But in all fairness, we should also point out that it's perhaps the most expensive substance known to science. It would literally bankrupt the United States of America to create usable quantities of antimatter. And that brings us to our special guest today, who will talk about fusion, a new source of energy. Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Professor Charles Seif, Professor of Journalism at New York University, author of a number of delightful books, including Zero, Alpha and Omega, and Decoding the Universe. And his latest book concerns a technology which may eventually, who knows when, solve the energy crisis. We're talking about fusion. The book is called Science in a Bottle, The Strange History of Fusion and the Science of Wishful Thinking. You realize that it may be possible to build a machine that runs on seawater. That's right, limitless seawater, and creates power from the sun. The energy source of the sun is called fusion, and we essentially want to bring a piece of the sun on the Earth and harness the energy source of the universe itself. Einstein's equation, E equals mc squared, is the secret of the stars. M, the mass of hydrogen, is turned into E, fabulous amounts of energy. And why don't we do that on the planet Earth?
As a consequence, nations, as well as fraudsters, hoaxsters, and tricksters, have jumped into this whole game of trying to create fusion in a laboratory. So once again, our special guest is Professor Charles Seif. The book is called Sun in a Bottle. And the question is, can we use the power of the sun to solve the energy crisis? Perhaps not today, but in the coming decades or maybe even a century. The question is, can we use the secret of the stars to energize our machines forever? Professor Seif, you're a journalist. However, you've written about cosmology, and now you've written a new book called Sun in a Bottle, The Strange History of Fusion and the Science of Wishful Thinking. So how did you, as a journalist, get interested in things that most journalists avoid, like the plague?
Well, I have to say I'm really a physics geek at heart. Back before I became a journalist, I studied physics and mathematics, and it was only fairly late in my education that I decided that I was more suited to writing than I was to actually performing scientific work. Mm-hmm. So even at the very beginning of my career, I was interested in writing about physics because that's what I loved. And so my career has been covering physics for a decade and change. And from the very beginning of the time that I was writing, among my first pieces was a large piece about fusion. And coming from the physics point of view, I thought of this wonderful thing which would solve the world's energy crises. And as a journalist approaching it, I saw that it was a little bit more complex than I had initially expected with my physics goggles on.
Okay, well, let's just jump right into your book. Your book starts out at some of the hairiest days of the Cold War. In 1945, the United States drops a fission bomb on Hiroshima and another fission bomb on Nagasaki based on uranium and plutonium. But then in the 1950s, a new race emerges, not with uranium and plutonium, but with the hydrogen bomb. So explain to us, what is the difference between the fission bombs that were dropped on Japan and the hydrogen bomb based on fusion?
Well, fission and fusion are two sides of the same coin. In some sense, every atom wants to be iron. It has iron envy. So things which are heavier than iron, like uranium and plutonium, want to split apart in the same sense that a ball wants to roll down a hill. And in the process of splitting apart, they release energy. Fusion, on the other hand, takes light elements. Light elements, in some sense, want to stick together and get heavier, getting closer to iron. It turns out that the fusion end of the reaction is more energetic per atom than fission. That is, breaking apart atoms gives you a lot of energy, but fusion, sticking them together, gives you a lot more. So at the end of the Manhattan Project, when the project ended, the United States had a bomb that used fission to power it. In its simplest form, basically all it did was take two hunks of uranium, stick them together, and wham, you get an explosion. So it was easy to do once you got the uranium material to set off the reaction. Edward Teller, a physicist at the Manhattan Project, was very strongly in favor of using the other side of the coin, fusion, because he realized that it would lead to a weapon of unlimited power, and he called it the super. And the idea basically was to use an explosion, a nuclear, a fission explosion, to set off a fusion explosion, which was much, much, much greater. And Teller was right. The weapon that he eventually created was vastly more powerful than even what obliterated Hiroshima and Nagasaki. To give you a sense of scale, Hiroshima was about a 14 kiloton explosion, the equivalent of 14,000 tons of TNT exploding in the same place at the same time. The first full fusion test, called Ivy Mike, was 10 megatons, 10 million tons, almost 1,000 times larger than Hiroshima. It evaporated the island it was on, and that was just the beginning. In theory, you can make a fusion bomb as large as you want. The biggest ever detonated was the Russian Tsar Bomba, which was more than 50 megatons of TNT. And after a certain point, it's pointless to get larger because you just wind up lifting a larger and larger column of atmosphere into space, so it doesn't do that much more damage. So even though it promised unlimited power, unless you wanted to destroy the Earth, it wasn't that much more effective at doing damage than a fission bomb. But at the same time, the Cold War was getting hot. The Russians had detonated their first nuclear weapon way before Americans thought they could get it, thanks in part to a spy operation that penetrated Los Alamos. So a panicked America realized, we have to get ahead of the Russians and keep nuclear supremacy. So they turned to Edward Teller's idea of a super bomb as a way of staying ahead of the Russian nuclear weapon industry. And as we know, the Russians caught up very, very quickly, and it turned into a nuclear stalemate where each side had so many weapons in their arsenal that they could destroy the world many times over.
And I should also point out that when I was in high school, Edward Teller was actually my advisor, and he actually sort of guided my career in the early years when I was at Harvard. However, moving on now, we have the Cold War in full swing, and people are now used to the idea that there is a bomb 1,000 times more powerful than the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bomb. But other people have said, well, look at Mother Nature. Mother Nature uses fusion to light up the heavens. So now explain to us how Mother Nature uses the process of fusion, not fission, to light up the universe.
Yes, it's fusion is responsible for all life on Earth. The sun is essentially a big ball of hydrogen. It's hydrogen gas, and when it was coalescing, it was compressing itself under its own gravity, and collapsing, compressing objects get hot in general, and so you got this ball of hydrogen that got hot and dense, hotter and denser, and eventually it got so hot and so dense that the hydrogen, moving extremely fast because of the energy of the temperature, the high temperatures involved, started slamming into each other with enough force to cause fusion reactions. So once you get a big ball of gas large enough to collapse under its own gravity and heat everything up high enough, you get a fusion reaction. And the fusion reaction is what makes the sun shine. These hydrogens getting converted eventually into helium release energy, and that energy shines out in all directions. That's what makes stars shine. But this reaction is extraordinarily difficult to get going. You need such an enormous ball of hydrogen to kickstart that fusion reaction that it's hard to do. Even a mass of hydrogen the size of Jupiter is almost like a star. The problem is it's not large enough to get so hot that you start that fusion reaction in its belly. So Jupiter is, in essence, everything that a star has except just that extra gravitational oomph to get it hot enough and tight enough to ignite.
And, in fact, in the movie 2010, Arthur C. Clarke talks about aliens igniting Jupiter, so our solar system becomes a double star system. However, Jupiter would have to be about 10 times bigger at minimum in order to get ignition. Now let's talk about the promise of fusion. Why has fusion hypnotized whole generations of inventors and quacks and top physicists? What is the promise of fusion? Why is there so much interest in it? Why have so many charlatans jumped into the game?
Imagine if you had a sun on your desktop, that in a little bottle you had a fusion reaction going. If you could get this, if you could have something like this, you basically have an unlimited source of energy. Hydrogen is abundant. It's the most abundant element in the universe. It's everywhere. It's in the oceans. Water is two atoms of hydrogen for one atom of oxygen. So if you were able to tap into the sun's reaction and turn hydrogen into helium and releasing energy in the process, you can turn this virtually unlimited source of fuel into energy for free. And because the fusion reaction, if you manage to get it working in the right way, you could just keep feeding hydrogen in and helium and energy come out. And helium is clean. I mean, if you wanted to, you could release it into the atmosphere and it would float up into space. And so this promises, in theory, unlimited energy with unlimited fuel and no waste. Reality is not quite as simple as that, but that is the promise.
Okay, and for the Spider-Man fans, for those people who saw Spider-Man 2, Dr. Octopus creates fusion in his laboratory in Manhattan, which is not the place to do it. But the machine looks like a little sun. It looks like actually a star. You can see sunspots and solar flares on this miniature sun. However, in real life, we don't expect to create a miniature sun like in Spider-Man 2. What will a fusion reactor really look like?
Well, there's two main areas that mainstream fusion researchers are looking at to make a real fusion reactor, and they are lasers and magnets. Lasers are a very clever way of getting the heat and pressure that you need to take a hydrogen pellet and make it collapse and start fusing. Basically, you shine laser light at all from all directions, and you squash a tiny pellet, and as it squashes, it compresses, and hopefully it ignites. And if you manage to get lasers that are strong and efficient enough that you create more energy out of that collapsing, fusing, tiny pellet of hydrogen than you consume by getting the lasers going in the first place, then you've got a source of energy. You've got a fusion reactor. No one has gotten that far, but it is theoretically possible. Another method is using magnets. It turns out that magnetic fields affect fusing plasmas like hydrogen. And if you shape a magnetic field right, you can create a bottle with which to contain a very hot cloud of hydrogen. And so a magnetic donut shaped right and with a cloud of hydrogen you throw heat in, eventually you might get a fusing plasma. And once you get that reaction going, you just have to figure out a way of piping new hydrogen in and piping fused helium out, and you've got a source of energy going. Again, these magnetic bottles aren't working to the point where you get more energy out than you put in heating the plasma and containing it. But in theory, if our magnets improve and our knowledge improves over time, you might have a magnetic bottle that contains a miniature sun.
Okay, now, because a fusion machine would use ordinary seawater, which is limitless pretty much, as the basic energy source, and because the energy released is almost limitless, the number of charlatans and quacks that have gone into the business is quite large. So let's talk about some of the false starts and some of the dashed hopes, beginning with a Dr. Richter, but the list is long. Let's talk about some of the false starts.
Yes, it's the goal is so lofty, that the unlimited energy, that the idea of fusion has attracted quacks and hoaxers and genuine scientists who are misguided from the very beginning. In 1951, the world was absolutely stunned to headlines that Argentina, of all places, had solved our energy problems forever. There was a German expat named Ronald Richter, who had convinced Juan Perón to fund a research laboratory on a secret island in the middle of a lake to get fusion reactions going in what he called a solar thermotron. And he kept the world going for about a year. People were arguing back and forth, could he have done it, could he not have done it? It turns out Richter was barking mad. He would get this wild look in his eyes and dump a whole bunch of gunpowder into his experiment and blow the doors off of his laboratory in gigantic explosions and rush out and write fusion on a piece of ticker tape. And yet, for many months, he kept Juan Perón's government believing that he was on his way to solving the world's energy crises, and this would be a great prestige for Argentina. Eventually, physicists in Argentina convinced Perón that something was going on that was a little fishy, they went and visited the laboratory with their own Geiger counters. And if, in fact, you have fusion reactions going, you should be able to detect neutron radiation coming off. And they detected nothing. So they proved that Ronald Richter was perpetrating a fraud. And contemporary accounts say that he wasted between $4 million and $70 million of the Argentinian treasury in the process of pursuing his dream. He disappeared off the world stage very rapidly, as you can imagine. But, in fact, everyone who is involved in fusion, some form, winds up deceiving themselves or deceiving others about their achievements. In 1958, British scientists at a very, very prestigious lab built this machine called Zeta. Zeta was a magnetic bottle of sorts, and the scientists had convinced themselves that they had gotten fusion in a laboratory. And they cracked open beers, they announced to the world that they were on their way to solving the world's energy crises. Turns out that they were wrong, that they were not seeing fusion, that they were deceiving themselves with neutrons. They were seeing neutrons, but it wasn't from fusion that they wanted. So they had to humiliate themselves on the world stage. After all these tabloids said energy to last a lifetime, no more energy bills, the British teams had to say, well, not really.
Okay, now more recently, we had this huge fiasco concerning two chemists, Pons and Fleischmann, who grabbed world attention, covers of, I think, Newsweek magazine and the New York Times, and everyone was talking about, well, did Pons and Fleischmann create fusion in a bottle? Not hot fusion, the hot fusion of lasers and magnets, but cold fusion. So tell us a little bit about cold fusion.
Yes. In 1989, two chemists, one of whom was extremely well celebrated, made this announcement to the press that absolutely stunned the world. They claimed that where these hot fusion, this magnetic fusion, this laser fusion research has been failing for years, wasting tens of billions of dollars, these two chemists, working independently, had spent $100,000, and they had solved the problem. And what they argued was that they managed to pipe hydrogen into a chunk of metal, a palladium, which has the interesting property that soaks up hydrogen like a sponge. And the theory was that if you get enough hydrogen in there, the hydrogen will be forced so close together that they might be forced to fuse.
And that concludes the first part of Exploration when we talked about fusion power, energy for the future. And if you're interested in the future, the next 50 to 100 years into the future, you may want to get a copy of my latest book, a New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Future. It goes all the way out to the year 2100. Is it possible to predict what a computer will look like 20, 50, 100 years in the future? What about medicine? What about longevity? These are the things covered in my book. I've interviewed over 300 of the world's top scientists to get you the most authoritative look over the next 100 years in science and our way of life.
Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a discussion with Professor Charles Seif, Professor of Journalism at New York University, author of an exciting new book called Sun in a Bottle, The Strange History of Fusion and the Science of Wishful Thinking. Well, the people ask the question, why do the stars shine? The stars shine because they burn hydrogen fuel to create helium waste product and in the process liberate enormous, fabulous amounts of cosmic energy, which is the engine of the universe itself. So wouldn't it be great if we could bottle it and use that to solve the energy crisis? Well, in principle, the laws of physics say that it should be possible. However, many hoaxers have jumped into the game, clouding up the picture. However, now nations of the world, the Europeans, the Japanese, the United States, are investing billions of dollars in a fusion reactor to be based in southern France, and maybe that will finally lay the genuine foundation for putting the sun in a bottle. So once again, our special guest today is Professor Charles Seif, professor of journalism at New York University, and we are talking about fusion, unlimited amounts of energy from seawater. Professor Seif, where we last left off, we were talking about the work of two chemists, Pons and Fleischmann, who made huge headlines in the early 1990s, stating that they were able to attain fusion in a bottle. Every single magazine cover and newspaper headline was devoted to the idea that perhaps we could have unlimited energy coming from a simple bottle. By using palladium metal, you could concentrate hydrogen, so they said, sufficient to fuse the hydrogen to create helium, in the process yielding unlimited energy. So what was the reaction to the work of Pons and Fleischmann, and, well, what happened?
So as you can imagine, as soon as this was announced, it was headlines everywhere. Cover of Time, cover of Newsweek, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, everywhere was talking about this for months and months and months. It turned out that the scientists were deceiving themselves. There was a bit of fishiness. Some data was moving back and forth. It's uncertain exactly what was going on, but when the cells were reproduced in better circumstances with more sophisticated equipment, it turned out that there was no excess energy, and more importantly, there were no neutrons coming out. Turns out when you fuse heavy forms of hydrogen together, you expect neutrons to fly away, and neutrons are a sign of fusion. They were seeing no neutrons, and that made it pretty clear that nothing was actually happening. No. However, it took it was a huge battle for years. Physicists versus chemists became a red state versus blue state thing, where the liberal elite physicists on the East Coast were trying to tear down research from chemists at the University of Utah. So it became a huge political battle that still affects the physics community on some level.
Now, you can simply calculate, using the back of an envelope, the neutron count that would occur if they really had fusion in a bottle, and it's sufficient to kill them. So the very fact that Pons and Fleischmann are still alive means that they could not possibly have attained fusion in a bottle. But then the question is, well, what did they attain? They did get net energy coming out. That's been verified by different laboratories. Some people have gone back to the literature on palladium back in the 1800s. It turns out that a person applied for a patent for one of the first cigarette lighters. He used palladium, put it in water, and attained a net amount of energy, which he used to light a flame. And he got a patent for it, a palladium cigarette lighter. And some people think that that's what they discovered. Well, what are your thoughts? It's been several years since then. What did Pons and Fleischmann really have in their bottle that gave energy? Was it a cigarette lighter or what?
It's really hard to tell. Palladium has an extraordinarily interesting chemistry. It has been fooling researchers for years, as you've noted, that not only is there that patent, in the early 20th century, two researchers thought they had achieved fusion in palladium. And because they were thinking along the same lines as Pons and Fleischmann were, and they thought they detected helium inside, an excess of helium inside palladium, which would be a nice sign of fusion because you're creating helium. It turns out that they were deceiving themselves because it turns out palladium soaks up helium just as well as it soaks up hydrogen, so you have enriched helium. So if they were seeing excess energy, and not entirely clear from the setup of the experiment that they were. I mean, they certainly thought they were. There was some sloppiness. But it's certainly possible that they were seeing it. It would most likely be a matter of chemistry, a chemical reaction where bonds are breaking, rather than a nuclear reaction where bonds in the center of a nucleus are being formed, the nuclear bonds that change atoms into other atoms are what are changed in a fusion reaction, as opposed to the attachments between atoms, which are chemical bonds, which are being changed in a chemical reaction like burning paper or cracking water. And so whatever they were seeing almost certainly was a chemical reaction. And chemical reactions are well studied, and there's only so much you can do for solving the world's energy problems with chemical reactions. In fact, burning gasoline is an extraordinarily efficient chemical reaction that allows us to power our cars. So it's not certain that there's anything there for solving the world's energy problems unless you have a nuclear reaction of some sort. It's pretty clear that that is not what they saw.
Now, to a physicist, it was absolutely staggering that you had these two respected chemists that didn't understand anything about the quantum theory. If you bring the protons together very closely, as you mentioned, then you could attain fusion. But you have to bring them really close, 10 to the minus 13 centimeters. However, in the Pons and Fleischmann experiment, these atoms were separated by 10 to the minus 8 centimeters. And you can simply, using a back of an envelope calculation, this is what we give our undergraduates. Our undergraduates can calculate that the fusion you get in a bottle is almost zero as a consequence. So for the physics community, what was absolutely staggering is the fact that chemists don't know any physics at all. Well, let's move on, because we had a story, another apparently fraudulent story that just took place a few months ago, this time at Oak Ridge National Laboratory, involving something called bubble fusion. So explain to us, what is bubble fusion, and how did the Nazis, of all people, first stumble onto this whole thing called sonoluminescence?
Yes, sonoluminescence is this really bizarre reaction, and it's only very recently been understood, where basically you take sound waves and you bombard a liquid with it, and you induce what's called cavitation. Under the right circumstances, if you hit water very hard, it actually behaves like a solid, and it can crack, and just for a tiny fraction of a second, you can cause a crack in water. And what happens when you have that crack is you create a little vacuum, and that vacuum causes water to evaporate and causes a bubble. By bombarding liquids with sound waves, you cause these bubbles, and if you time those sound waves just right, you can cause those bubbles to collapse very dramatically. And it was discovered that if you do this just right, you get such a dramatic collapse that you get some sort of reaction. No one quite knows exactly what it is, even today, that causes a little flash of blue light. So if you turn off the lights and you bombard a tub of water with sound, you can actually get tiny little lights. And it's poorly understood, but it's really cool. You've got a mechanism for compressing and heating something, and a gentleman out at Oak Ridge named Rusi Taliarkhan came up with a clever idea of how to get enormous bubbles by shooting neutrons into the liquid that would collapse dramatically. And his hope was that by having this dramatic collapse and heating and compression, you might actually induce fusion in the center of the bubble.
Now, let's back up a bit. The Nazis, when they built their submarines and ships, noticed sonoluminescence as coming out of their propeller blades. They noticed these little tiny bubbles begin to luminesce. So luminescence only takes place when you reach thousands of degrees, like burning a flame, for example. So wasn't it that led scientists to believe that you could attain high temperatures, that the collapse of these bubbles collapse very spherically, would in fact create thousands of degrees, and then the next step is to get millions of degrees, in which case you have a sun in a bottle, right?
That's absolutely correct. And that the example of the Nazis is very interesting because the reason that they cared about submarine blades cavitating is because it makes noise too. So they were studying cavitation to make their submarine blades quieter. And when they discovered this, you look at this light, and light is caused by hot objects, and the color of the light that's coming off, which is blue, it indicates a very high temperature. And so scientists were reasonable to think that maybe if you enhance this somehow, maybe you might get fusion. And so Taliyarkhin was not crazy. I mean, this was a chain of logic which was not out there. And if he achieved it, he would have been celebrated around the world. In fact, when the story broke that he claimed to have created fusion by these sound waves, it was headlines all over the world.
So what finally happened? I mean, his university begins to look at these studies. Other universities begin to try to duplicate this. Did he really attain millions of degrees, not just thousands now, like the Nazis did, but millions of degrees sufficient to create neutrons?
Yeah, it was a very complicated story. When he turned in his paper, some of his colleagues at Oak Ridge were very skeptical. So they tried to reproduce his experiment where he was claiming to get fusion, and they failed again to find these telltale neutrons. And that was an early indicator that Taliyarkhin was not seeing what he thought he wanted, what he thought the data was showing him. And so from very early on, there were people fighting. Physicists were trying to, some big-name physicists were trying to knock down Taliyarkhin's paper even before it got published in Science Magazine. And Science Magazine got angry that these scientists were trying to block the peer review process. So it became a big kerfuffle, and a lot of political fighting went on. Taliyarkhin eventually moved to Purdue University, and at Purdue, some of his graduate students reproduced his experiments. And other researchers on the outside mostly had negative data, kind of saying that he didn't get what he had achieved. But the paper, which was published by his graduate students, didn't have his name on it. And because of this, Taliyarkhin was accused of misconduct. There were a number of other accusations leveled at him having to do with fishiness of data and something having to do with money coming from the Department of Defense. And Congress got involved trying to figure out whether Taliyarkhin was causing fraudulence to happen in the university environment. Just a couple of months ago, in August, the verdict came down that, in fact, Taliyarkhin was guilty, according to Purdue, of research misconduct. And it's a really sad story because Taliyarkhin started off doing the right thing. What a scientist is supposed to do is he's supposed to do an experiment, and he's supposed to publish his experiment in a peer-reviewed journal and let the university, let researchers around the nation look at it, try to reproduce it. And science is self-correcting. Over time, if the result is wrong, the community will say it's wrong. So he started out with this process, which all scientists do. And I think that the problems with fusion, the fact that there's so much power here, causes this corruption influence to infiltrate. And the stakes are so high that it's hard to do things by the book. And people deceive themselves, and they deceive other people in this quest. And I think Taliyarkhin is a victim of the fusion bug that bites so many people.
Now, let me ask you a philosophical question about this. Some people claim that these people are hoaxers, that they're liars and cheats. They know they are cheats. They know they're liars, but they think they can get away with it. Other people think that they were misguided, that their data was not quite what they thought it was, wishful thinking set into play. For example, in South Korea, we have the most famous scientist of South Korea who claimed to have been able to clone human cells being shown to be a total fraud. And then the question is, why did he risk the entire reputation of the South Korean scientific community by perpetuating a fraud? I talked to one scientist, and he said, very simple, that sooner or later someone was going to clone human cells, so
he figured if he faked it, he would get credit for it. And then sooner or later, a few months later, someone would really do it, and therefore he would get credit for someone else's work. That's the logic there, which is actually rather interesting. So what do you think? Do you think this person was a total fake? Do you think that he was misguided? Or do you think that he was a fake and thought he could get away with it because a few months later, somebody else would then do it correctly?
Yeah, it's interesting because as you interview people in fusion and in science in general, you encounter these hoaxers and these people who perpetuate fraud. Some of them believe it. Some of them are complete hoaxes, and some are somewhere in between. I believe that Teliaarchon actually believed that he had achieved fusion. I still think that he believes it. I think he is genuinely deceiving himself. Some of his actions, I believe, cross the line, at least into bad science. I think he is aware of that, but I think he's absolutely convinced that he's correct and that these cutting the corners here and there are a means to an end of proving himself correct. And it's a real shame because had he not cut those corners, I think he would continue to be a researcher. He might be embarrassed by something that was disproven, but he would maintain a reputation. The moment you start moving to areas where other people accuse you of fraud, your scientific career is over and you move to the fringe. However, there are a great number of people in the fringe who are willing to embrace you. So there are careers even after a hoax. And I wouldn't call bubble fusion a hoax, but I would call it a level that there is deception going on.
Okay, now let's move on. We talked about cold fusion. We talked about bubble fusion. And now let's get back to hot fusion, specifically the ITER, a multi-billion-dollar fusion experiment to be based in southern France, which they claim will attain break-even, that is generating as much energy as you put into it, by the year 2018, in 10 years' time. So tell us a little bit about the ITER and this multi-billion-dollar effort by the Europeans, the Japanese, and the United States.
Yes. ITER is the biggest scientific endeavor on Earth at the moment. It's breaking ground in the south of France, probably going to be a beautiful lab to visit once it's built. And it's going to cost, the scientists say, $10 billion. I think it's probably going to be $20 billion plus by the time it's over. So it's absolutely huge by scientific standards. And it was conceived, the earliest versions are in the 1980s, having to do with Reagan and Gorbachev were deciding on international collaborations. They thought fusion would be a good idea. It's been on again, off again since the 1980s, trying to get the money. United States was in, then they pulled out, they're in again, and now it is really breaking ground. And so the goal is to have a startup. A few months ago, they bumped it forward. It used to be 2016, now it's 2018. And the goal is to get, what you say, break even, that as much energy out as in. It may or may not reach that goal, and especially if you do your accounting properly, looking at the efficiency of the magnets, it's almost certainly not going to achieve break-even.
You sure about that? Because if you take a look at their press releases, they have to, of course, propagandize their project, but they tend to be optimistic that they will attain break-even.
Yes, and they have to be optimistic, and I think there's a chance that they will do it. I'm not willing to wager that much one way or the other against them, but I would say that it's likely not. Because if you look at press releases, if you look carefully in the archive of press releases, fusion researchers have already claimed break-even with machines like this. They claim it regularly. The JET machine in England has claimed break-even. And a Japanese machine called JT60, just within the past few years, have claimed break-even in some form. But if you look at the numbers carefully, they're getting 60-70% of the energy that they put in back out. And so if history is any guide, I would expect they won't achieve break-even. And I'm willing to bet quite a bit of money, in fact. I've put $1,000 on the Long Bets Foundation website that by the year 2050, there won't be a working power plant that puts more energy out for real than sucks in.
So who did you bet against? Because most physicists would tend to be more optimistic about attaining break-even and commercialization by mid-century. Who did you bet against?
It's an open bet. It is anyone who wishes to take me up. No, I have not gotten a challenger yet. It's just been announced. So anyone who wants to go to longbets.org and look up the bet, I'm happy to take the challenge.
Okay, well, I put a bet on longbets.org for $1,000, saying that by 2020, somebody will get a Nobel Prize for some version of string theory. So we have to be a little bit optimistic, say the scientists, because pessimists never make history. Pessimists never win Nobel Prizes. But I guess you tend to be more pessimistic. Well, most scientists, I think, would say that this is a Manhattan Project where you have to put enough effort to get critical mass, and that previous efforts never attained critical mass, but the ITER, they claim, will attain critical mass. Is there a law of physics preventing critical mass, preventing break-even from being attained?
No, absolutely not. And I think this is a worthwhile endeavor, even though my book is pessimistic. I think if civilization lasts to the year 3000, I think we are going to look back and we are going to be, everything will be powered by fusion, and we will look back at a course of research that led to fusion power plants that are basically providing all of humans' energy needs. Do I think that it's going to be achieved by 2100? I don't think so. But certainly it's going to be there sometime. What interests me, though, in the story is this consistent need to think that it's just around the corner. Even if this is a 150-year campaign to do something, the need to convince yourself that you're going to see it in your lifetime is so great that great, great, brilliant scientists are unable to see that they are not going to achieve their goals in the short term.
Okay. Well, any parting thoughts for somebody who wants to pick up a copy of your book, Sun in a Bottle, The Strange History of Fusion and the Science of Wishful Thinking?
Well, I think the story of fusion is just fascinating, and not just because of the science involved, but because of the sociology of the people who are trying so hard to get this ultimate goal and trying with all their effort to do good for humanity, and have so far come short. And it's tragic and comic at the same time. And as you mentioned, I think it is necessary for humanity in the long run. So it's just chapter one in what may be a very, very long tale.
And that concludes our interview with Professor Charles Seif, author of a new book called Sun in a Bottle, The Strange History of Fusion and the Science of Wishful Thinking. Well, in the last few minutes of exploration, I'd like to interject my own two cents worth concerning the future of energy in the United States. I think it's pretty clear that in the next 10 years, we're going to see a lot of volatility, a lot of ups and downs with regards to energy, because we are, quite frankly, running out of oil. We are at the top of what is called Hubbert's Peak, the point at which we have exhausted 50% of the world's energy supplies of fossil fuels. Now, it turns out that we would have to discover a new Saudi Arabia every 10 years or so in order to meet the demands of the rising Chinese, the rising Indians, and the rising middle class around the world. And that's simply not going to happen. So in the next 10 years, I foresee a certain amount of chaos because, well, quite frankly, solar is not ready for prime time. Wind, solar, we're all in favor of that. We're all in favor of renewable technologies, but it's going to take a lot of subsidies and jump starts and tax credits to get renewable technologies off the ground. However, with the rising cost of oil over the next several years and the falling cost of solar hydrogen, I think the two curves will cross perhaps within 10 years or so, and this could initiate a solar hydrogen era. However, then the question is, can solar hydrogen really supply all our energy needs, especially because people are going to be demanding a middle-class lifestyle like they see in the Hollywood movies? Well, then even the limits of solar hydrogen start to come into play. Hydrogen, for example, does not generate new energy. It simply allows you to transport energy from one place to another via hydrogen fuel cells. And this means that the electricity has to come from somewhere, and the logical conclusion is coal. So at least in the next few years, coal, unfortunately, will be the big winner. As we go from oil-based cars to electricity-based cars to hydrogen-based cars, the energy supply for the electric car will unfortunately have to come mainly from coal. Now then, this leaves the question, what about mid-century? By mid-century, fusion should be a mature technology. There's no law of physics preventing the ITER, to be based in southern France, from attaining break-even. We just have to throw money at it. However, there are a lot of technical problems. It may take perhaps several generations of ITER reactors before commercialization takes place. But many people believe that, well, perhaps by mid-century, we may have the commercialization of fusion reactors, in which case seawater could give us, in principle, unlimited sources of energy. Now, we've been disappointed before. Every 20 years, the joke goes, people predict that we'll have fusion in the next 20 years. Well, that 20 years comes and goes, and we still don't have fusion. However, this time, the nations of the world have made it a top priority, a crash program, to finally jumpstart the fortunes of fusion. Right now, we just have technical problems concerning the instability of the plasma. But again, with supercomputers, more experience, and prototypes, there's nothing to prevent us from eventually commercializing fusion power. Again, don't hold your breath, but by mid-century, perhaps our children and grandchildren may live in a world of solar hydrogen fusion. Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Professor Charles Seif, Professor of Journalism at New York University, and the book is called Sun in a Bottle. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. So once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku for Exploration. Join us every week when we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. Good day.